Hello and welcome to the writer's block. Yes, people, it's the writer's block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. ish here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. We are on Black People Time in honor of Juneteenth, but we are finally here. We have finally arrived. The racist internet providers will not silence black voices on the internet. That's a joke there. But it is a Sunday, and I'm just happy to be here, be happy to provide you with 2 hours of much necessary entertainment, propaganda, education, whatever it is I'm doing here. And with me tonight, I have the lovely Cyan Quinn. She's program director for Countercurrents. And from what I understand, she's become something of an institution in her own right on the white identitarian and white nationalist right. Cyan, how are you doing tonight?
You are far too kind. That's extremely generous. I'm doing great. We are getting ready for the 4th of July, which is Juneteenth for white people. So as of the last few years, black people have had their own separate Independence Day. White people can have their Independence Day. It is, after all, White History Month. I believe we'll be discussing some interesting happenings with Jesse Lee Peterson later, but it is White History Month, so that still stands regardless what's going on with him. So we may be on Black People Time today due to the internet in rural areas, but I'm ready to go. Happy 4th of July, all Americans, and to everybody else, hello. Welcome to the Writer's Block.
Well, that's funny you should say that 4th of July is Juneteenth for white people, because you're not going to believe it, but somebody made that joke just like 15 minutes before we started this show. You know who you are. I know you're listening. So my hand to my heart, Cyan did not hear that from me.
To give the right person credit, I think it might have been Robert Hampton. I wish I could remember. If you're listening, just go ahead and credit yourself in the comments down there. I did not make that up, but I love it, and I'll repeat it.
It is actually a very good observation that basically Juneteenth is this attempt to push out for the 4th of July as the midsummer type celebration of the American civic religion. But we're going to get into those big brain topics right now. We're going to get them into them later. Right now, we have some crass financial concerns to address, because as Cyan can tell you better than anyone else, Countercurrents is turning out to be a very expensive operation to run, and we need your help. We need your funds. We are raising funds. We're having a funds raiser. Apparently, this is what it's called when you're raising funds for things at Countercurrents. We are trying to keep it as an institution afloat, constantly producing content for you, constantly just churning out all the articles you want to read. And of course, this takes money. So I'm inviting you very warmly to donate to Countercurrents through Entropy and through Cash App. Now, you can use Entropy to send us super chats, as they call them. You can ask me questions. You can ask Cyan questions. If you're just thinking you're just saying we're doing a great job, you can also say that. This is what Entropy is for. You can also use Cash App. Now, you won't be able to send questions or messages to us through Cash App, but they do take a smaller percentage. And I hear it's just more convenient. I haven't used it before. I usually forward all of my donations to Countercurrents through Entropy, because that way I can just ask a question. Now, we can also take money on DLive in the form of DLive tokens. So you got your lemons, you got your ice creams, you got your ninja guineas, your ninjets, your diamonds, and you can donate those to us, and they are very well appreciated. It's going to be very interesting, I guess, 50 years from now, when we have won and songs are sung about the writer's block and us heroically saving the white race. I'm guessing the archaeologists of the future will be wondering, what the hell were ninja guineas, and why did people have Greg Johnson cast this incantation? Because people loved hearing Greg say ninja guinea for whatever reason. And of course, you can donate to us on Odyssey. On Odyssey, we take library tokens, which are Odyssey's own cryptocurrency, as well as cash money. You can give us a money tip on Odyssey. Those are all the ways you can directly donate to ConnerCurrents. Now, there is one final way. It's indirect, so which means it's more subtle. You can purchase the fine products of Alaska Chaga. This is me sniffing and slurping delicious Alaska Chaga. Oh, it's particularly strong tonight. Mrs. Gillaby was commenting that it's particularly big Chaga piece. I will be sleeping well tonight, I can tell you that. You can also purchase some of their fine soaps and any other products over on the Alaska Chaga website, alaskachaga.us, if our heroic moderators would just dump that into the chat so that people can access Alaska Chaga and purchase their fine product. And I do believe that is all the panhandling, shilling, and craft financial concerns for tonight. I do believe we can now dive into the meat of the matter. Folks, believe it or not, the month of June has elapsed, and we have accumulated quite a number of excellent articles on countercurrents.com. And as you know, it is our end of month tradition to have a best month ever type show, which means we are going to be reviewing a selection of articles which have been published in on countercurrents.com for the month of June with a fellow writer, with a fellow contributor to Countercurrents, because it's the writer's block. You got to be a writer to get on the best month ever type shows. And here we have Cyan Queen, who's just, she's just not just one of the floor writers. No, not one of us lowly pedestrian writers. She's program director for Countercurrents. And now people should already know you. I hear you're something of a celebrity. I hear people have you been calling you an e-girl. I don't know if you'd fit the definition, but you're a girl. You're on the internet. That's one of those things, I guess. So why don't you introduce yourself to someone who may not have heard of you ever before?
That's right. Well, thank you again so much for the kind introduction. It's a bit much. I definitely am not in, you know, when you invited me on the show, of course, I was delighted and happy to be here and to speak with you. But I would not consider myself any kind of like ideologue or on par with a lot of our other writers. I'm really happy to be here. I'm happy to help make Countercurrents function. I started working with Countercurrents in a volunteer capacity back at the end of 2016 as the food lady at the Northwest Forum. So back in the Pacific Northwest, Greg Johnson was putting on a bi-monthly conference where he would rent out a venue space, invite, three or four speakers, and then a bunch of us would attend and we would listen to the speeches. And it was just the speeches were kind of extra. Really, the point was to get together, to socialize, to have fascinating discussions about history, politics, everything. It was a ton of fun. But at the time, Greg would provide donuts and coffee. And then about halfway through, people would start getting the sugar crash. And so I noticed this. And so I started bringing sandwiches in the middle of the day, because people need to eat, to keep these conversations flowing and keep the mood up. So I started helping out in that capacity and just had a great time. And then in about 2017 or 2018? I think it's 2017. Greg, he was doing so many different things at the time. He had the Northwest Forum going. He had the New York Forum going. And he also was running Countercurrents, of course. And then on top of that all, he started getting harassed by Antifa in Seattle. And so it was, he was beginning to back away from holding the Northwest Forum. And so myself and a collection of volunteers just said, well, this is extremely important to us socially, but it's also a good way to to refine our ideas and discuss these topics in a free environment, if you can believe that, actual free speech, and develop friendships and bring in interesting people. And so I said to myself, well, okay, I can call a venue, I can order donuts and more. And so why not get it started? So I had organized events professionally and just volunteer for several years. And so I decided to take a crack at it. And we kept it going for about a year and a half before my own docs in 2019. And I got an opportunity to move across the country and work for VDARE. So I did that for a couple of years, and now that Countercurrents has grown to the point where we can have a formalized program, we can professionalize our back office. There's enough donations coming in to really get, expand the organization. It was like coming home to me. So I'm back with Countercurrents, and I'm going to stay here till I die.
That's very interesting. But that would be typical Greg. I mean, he does have these Italian sensibilities of, hey, let's front load on espresso and pastries. When I was in Italy, and people have been commenting about me fanning myself. This is from Sicily. I don't know if you can read. When I was in Italy, they really do eat like that. They front load the very heavy carbs, the sugars, the pastries, and the espresso. And I can only say I am very jealous of Italian metabolisms. They eat so much carbohydrates, drink so much espresso. You look at these people, they do everything wrong by the standard of, health conscious Western people. But it's amazing. They stay so skinny, and it's like, the classic trope of Italian man in Speedos. And they actually look very good in the Speedos. Personally, I'm a boxer's man. I wore Speedos when I was playing water polo. I'm never wearing Speedos for as long as I live. I live and die by my boxer swimming shorts. They're all the colors of the rainbow, very nice floral prints. But we are running a serious operation. Cyan is actually running a serious operation in the back office of Countercurrents. She is the heroic back-end developer, so you people can tune into my ugly face every Sunday. Every Sunday, like a broken clock, sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's 10 and 8 minutes p.m., Central European time, 4 p.m. on the East Coast of America, 1 p.m. on the West Coast. But it's essential. It's essential work you're doing over there. And sometimes it's as simple as bringing a bunch of sandwiches to hungry people, which it would be heroic, I would have said. And that's, we have our first donation for the evening from Glorious Bastard. So not an
I love the way you say that with the hard D at the end.
Right. So it's not an inglorious bastard. It's a glorious bastard, right? It's not bastard. It's bastard, just like the Tarantino film. He donated one ice cream. Well, thank you for that, sir. And hopefully you will be our bare white person when we finally get our squad going. And I think this is a good moment to segue into the meat of the matter, which is the best month ever at Countercurrents. This month of June, well, June bugs and Juneteenths, we have quite a selection of articles to review here. And since Cyan spoke about, that most feminine of virtues, the provision of fine dining, let's talk about femininity. Let's talk about Catherine S.'s Perilously Fair Reflections. Perilously Fair Reflections on the Ladies of the Lake, which is, the classic Catherine S. She gathers a bunch of examples of the same thing, the same archetype in the literature of Western man, of white people, and she presents to us an image, which is, first and foremost, beautiful. Second, educational. Third, didactic and motivational. This is what I love about Catherine articles, but she picked the subject of femininity as related to the function of cupbearer in religious ritual and the lake as a body of water, which is a repository of the feminine, apparently. Cyan, what are your impressions of Catherine's article?
Oh, I loved it. Catherine S. is one of my absolute favorite new writers, and not just out of feminine solidarity, but she's really brilliant, erudite, articulate. And I had the honor of meeting her in Columbus at our Columbus gathering earlier this year. And, you know, I'm not going to dox her, but she is, you know, just as beautiful as she is in person, as she comes across in her writing. It's just really, really wonderful. One of the things that had always attracted me to Countercurrents, as opposed to other right-wing nationalist sites, was its appreciation in featuring history and literature. And so Catherine S. has done an amazing job bringing these pieces of our inherited cultural heritage to the forefront, not only in this article, but also she had a fantastic article a few months ago. In fact, this was right before February on Rome. And yes, each of these items in our history is it belongs to us. Greg Johnson said at one point, one of the reasons Countercurrents focuses on literature is because it's our history. All of it is white history. And we need to claim it as ours too. So I really appreciated this article, and I really am so happy that Catherine S. has joined the writing team.
Right. It's amazing. I consider Catherine to be one of our most valued, I'm going to say assets, our most valued people over at Countercurrents. I've certainly availed myself of her impressive intellect and erudition for my own writings and for the writer's block. She's a regular. I think if you count people by frequency of appearance, she has the lead with 3 appearances, right? Just because I would say we have very similar interests, right? I too come from the world of literature, and I have a lifelong interest in history, which is why I'm here, which is why I'm not doing something else, which is why I'm writing for Countercurrents, which is why I'm making this show, because, well, my interest in history led me to this idea of white identitarianism, that this idea we do have a right to be on this planet as white people, that we shouldn't just disappear no matter what. And from that little sliver of self-legitimacy, you could say, I grew into what I am not right now, a full-fledged ideologue of the white identitarian right. So I guess that's something to think about. Now, I wanted to ask you specifically about the ideas of femininity. I love how Catherine links it to the function of the cupbearer. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with these, let's call them esoteric rituals, or maybe ancient pagan rituals, rituals of European native faith. But the function of cupbearer, the function is, that's actually very important. And more often than not, this has been filled by a woman, a priestess, a high priestess, or domestic cult, this would probably be the wife of the patriarch who actually bears the cup. Have you any thoughts on how do we resurrect the energy and sacredness of femininity in the modern age? We are witnessing a dissolution of gender norms and roles, not only in the sense that there's a bunch of trans people around. No, we are seeing men becoming unmanly. We are seeing women becoming unwomanly. How do we combat this? What can we even do?
Right. That's a very good observation, and it's something that comes out in one of the things that stands out in the article to me is that it paints a deep and broad picture of women, right? Women in the right, online at least. I mean, maybe this is what they mean by e-girls, you know, women who are who pose themselves as traditional women in sundresses. There's nothing wrong with that. I need to get that out there at first. But someone asked me this recently, you know, how do we get more women in white nationalism? How do we get more women in the right generally? And I think we just need to acknowledge that the in this age particularly, but just generally, there's so much more to the woman than just the person in the sundress at home with 10 babies. I mean, that's a good thing. It really is. But they also have deep ideological drives, like Catherine's first example, Antigone. She had this deep ideological drive. She needed to take care of her brother, you know, who had died out in the battlefield. And, you know, there's more to women than than just that offset. So, you know, it's not a one-dimensional character. That when you bring up the cupbearer, that's something that I think appeals to women too, because that's another thing that we can do. I've been to several Ossetru folk gatherings, and I don't really talk about religion too much publicly, but I do really appreciate the cultural inheritance that we have from paganism, you know, as well as Protestantism and Catholicism. I understand it can be divisive, but in this particular instance, when I was at these gatherings, the woman, it was actually led by Steve and Sheila McNallen. They run an organization called the Ossetru Folk Assembly in North America, and during their gatherings, Sheila would spend some time with the women, and we would have the chance to bring up, you know, womanly topics. But also, her role in that ritual was to bring the cup of mead to Stephen, and before the ritual itself, and that was a very important role.
Yes, it reminds me of a ritual which is often practiced in the Jilvi household. It's the ritual of the rising of the lazing bum. It happens about noonish. And Mrs. Jilvi arrives with a cup of coffee and attempts to raise me from my bed. I am the titular lazy bum. She does not often succeed. I am very persistent in my sloth, but sometimes it happens. No, that's just a joke. I'm actually quite the insomniac, and more often than not, I don't sleep at all. Might be the effect of 7 espressos a day, but who knows?
Hey, coffee's great.
Yeah, I'm completely addicted to the bean water, and people have been saying to me, you know, maybe you should cut back, but no, I'm not going to do it. It just depresses me when I try not to drink coffee. It's very important, I think, for women to have their own spaces, which I don't think that women really do have spaces. It's not just that women can't get together without men being around. That women can still do. It's the men who don't have spaces without females. But I think that the onus on modern woman is to quite literally in the Shakespearean way, as Lady Macbeth would say it, to unsex themselves, to become less feminine, to basically become men or something approaching men, really see the onus on, oh, let's have a career, let's have a this. Whereas just the gender division of the ritual, right? And I've observed some, you know, let's call them non-Christian rituals, mm-hmm. right? The man wields something which is always either a tool or a weapon. In these rituals, he presides over the proceedings. The herald is also a man, right? And the woman is always the cupbearer, or more often than not, someone acted upon. The very fact that there are two different, very clearly delineated gender-related norms, this anchors us to biological reality in a way which, say, abstract ideology does not. I mean, ideology is the poor man's religion. There is no, for example, in Marxism, there is no specifically female role. If you read female, you know, Marxists or Marxist women calling themselves feminists, what they're really concerned with is becoming men, you know, erasing the distinction between the sexes. And this is, yeah, this is why I wanted specifically to discuss this with you, because not only are you a woman, you are a very feminine woman, right? I like that. I like that it's evident in your voice. And you come to my show, we talk politics, and you talk about how you brought sandwiches for everybody. I wish more women could be like you, especially as a sandwich gourmet enjoyer of sandwiches.
I should probably clarify in terms of what I do for Countercurrents. The program director role does not, it's not just bringing sandwiches to the office, although in fact we all work remotely or to get togethers. We're doing a lot of stuff right now, and I should actually, you know, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't bring these things up, so I should just briefly mention too, and thank you to all of our listeners and supporters, that we're doing a handful of things in the background. We have 5 events coming up planned this year. We're planning events in Atlanta, in Texas, in Columbus, in California, Maryland, and Europe, others. So there's a lot going on here. And of course, there will be food at these events. So I guess so that's definitely part of it. There's a lot of other stuff too that's happening behind the scenes. We mentioned, Nick, you mentioned our one of our sponsors, Alaska Chaga. Everybody, if you go to the Countercurrents homepage, go look on the right there, and you'll see the sponsored link section. That is new to us. That is one of the things that helps sustain Countercurrents now on a regular basis. So click that link for Alaska Chaga and then buy it. In fact, buy all of it. They not only sell chaga, but they also sell chocolate and all kinds of goodies. Antelope Hill is up there. So we appreciate their support as well. We've got Vital Elements, which is a rune course by Paul Wagner. So take a look at that, please. And then the Populist Delusion, we're advertising that right now for Imperium Press. So we thank you for your support. And then we have links below for American Renaissance, Patrick Ryan's show, The Occidental Observer, and of course, the fantastic Jim Goad. So take a look at that. That is new. That's one of the things we've been working on. We also have, you know, everybody talks about founding the white ADL, how we need a white ADL. And there's a lot of talking about it, but something that we've been working on quietly, behind the scenes is actually building it and creating it. And, this has been going on for the past 6 months, and, I just filed some paperwork on Friday, and that's about all I can say. But, you know, this is one of my roles back here. So, we definitely eat well while it's happening. But this is one of the ways that we're expanding at Countercurrents. So, in terms of the feminine roles, I think that women can be feminine. And also, you know, some people may question, okay, well, you, promote traditional gender roles, but you are a working parent and a working mom. Well, you know, how do you reconcile those two? And I think that, you know, especially, so in modern times, I don't like it when the media or television or things portray that to be the norm, that the woman has to be the man, has to put on the work pants, has to be a lawyer. There's a new movie coming out that where they're redoing the Hulk, and the Hulk is a woman lawyer. I mean, it's this kind of stuff is disturbing. Jeez. I don't think women actually like watching this either. That's why we're drawn to, all of these older films, Downton Abbey, The Northmen, these other.
Downton Abbey is subversive. Let's not get ourselves.
That's true.
The later seasons in particular were quite a drag. I will say that. I liked, maybe it's just the history buff in me, but I liked the focus on pre-war things and the war itself, right? This First World War, but
Right. I guess the overarching point is that we're drawn to more traditional gender roles, and that's because it's what's natural to a society. But what we're trying to do, we have this religion of wokeness. It is that cultural Marxism, like you were saying earlier, removing the differences between men and women. They are trying to make everyone just atomized individuals. This is one of the disturbing things that I saw. I used to go on this website called it's libcom.com. I think it's still there, but it's a it's an anarchist communist forum website where people discuss ideas, and one of the ideas that they're proposing is kinder communism, and that's where they take away children from the parents and they're raised by the state. I mean, which frankly, that's kind of what public school is starting to do, is you're taking the children away from both parents now who are forced to work, and the state is raising them instead of the parents raising them. This was one of the things that was particularly shocking to me back in the day before I really developed my worldview. Everybody is atomized. As for the roles of women and men in society and how to get back to that, I mean, I think there's someone who emailed me the other day, Alexandra Oh, she's a commenter on the site, and also a supporter. If you're listening, thank you so much. I think this was a fantastic question. In fact, she was commenting, she was making a comment jumping off of Catherine S's article here, where she states that a third of our readers are women. And she was asking me, well, how do you, how do we connect with that 30 to 34%? Where are they? And focus on our femininity. And one of the things that I think it's so difficult for women in modern time is to find, and this ties with another article that we'll be discussing too about male relationship fantasies, is that it's hard for women to find a man, frankly, who can support a family because of the wage depression due to immigration. So I think that, instead of enforcing there's one argument out there where you could enforce gender roles, from a top-down society, but also I think men and women would naturally fall into these traditional gender roles if we solved the immigration issue. We need to impose an immigration moratorium, mandatory e-verify, deport all illegals, abolish birthright citizenship, and impose heavy taxes on remittances. I think this would encourage voluntary repatriation, and it would improve the labor and the housing market for, existing, I'm going to say Native Americans because that's the historic American nation.
Let's just go with white Americans. I like that term, mm-hmm. white. It's very definite. There's no beating around the bush with it. There's just no way you can say, we are talking about all races are equal. No, you get right to the meat of the matter. You cut right to the bone. White Americans, Americans of the white race, which is, I like definite statements. Mm-hmm. I like to know where I am, with people, with statements, with philosophies, and this is why I prefer this term, white Americans. This is ultimately the goal of our movement, to make sure that white people the world over, including white Americans, the historic American nation, actually do not merely survive, but thrive. But we are looking also at equality of life, not just quantity of life type approach. I will say that I will add to everything you just said that women working is not opposed to tradition. Women not working, or more specifically, women working in a domestic role as housewives, is actually recent. It's very modern. It's a product of the 20th century, maybe the 19th for the middle class, but for working class people, it only really became a reality somewhere in the middle of the 20th century. You could say the 30s, 40s, 50s. Historically, women worked. It's very traditional, for example, in Macedonian folk tales to read about the man and the wife going to the fields together, and where the man would plow, right? The woman would be behind him with a backhoe and turning the ground wherever he missed, or you know, maybe doing some minor, less strength and intensive tasks around the field, around the house with animals. What is new, what is inimical to tradition, is women working outside of the house and therefore being in the power of, more often than not, other men, or worse, other women, right, in the workplace. Whereas historically, women would work, and they would work very hard in the fields with animals, or textile work. This was all done by women in the past. There were no sweatshops in Malaysia, right? But they would be in the power of either their father, their husband, maybe their brother, if the father had died and they were still unmarried. They would be under, as the Romans would put it, sub manus, under the hand of some man, and he would direct them. And this would not be slavery like some people seem to imagine, but it would be guidance. It would be a man comes before a woman. A woman, I mean, this is the way God ordained things. We are here on his planet. We are not here to change the way things are. But yeah, women working, I'm not against it. Women working outside the house, it's less than ideal. What can I say?
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but there was this great author and podcast guest, Countercurrents Radio guest, who I haven't seen in a while, and I want him to come back, Rob Kievsky. If you look up some of his old podcasts, there's one that I particularly remember where he was proposing alternative economic solutions, you know, to keep families together and also work at the same time and carve out an economic niche for whites in America. And one of the ideas that he brought up was the example of the convenience store, like the family convenience store. You know, in fact, here's a good topic for Rich. I would love to see Rich Hauck and Rob Kievsky on a CC radio episode together, or maybe a writer's block episode too. You know, hey, both of them are great. But I'd love to hear them talk about this idea, because Rich Hauck, of course, is the 7-Eleven nationalist, and then Rob Kievsky presents this. But the reason he does this is because, you know, family businesses are a way for, you know, that you have for the family to stay together, right? You have, let's say you have the storefront. If it's in a building that allows you to do this, you have an apartment upstairs and then you have the storefront downstairs. A bookstore would be a fantastic option too, where, you know, the family is home, you know, can go back and forth. You can do homeschooling. The child, you know, can learn some responsibilities if they want to. I mean, I'm not advocating for child labor here, but I mean, one example is the forums. When I was doing them in Seattle with the volunteers, you know, I had a full-time job, and then we would do this, you know, for fun on the weekends. And it's a family activity. My daughter would be with us. She would fold the programs. She would be in charge of figuring out what the other kids who attended might want to do. You know, we would pick out crafts together. So this industrial type of society where, you know, the children go to public school and are raised by the state, and then the parents go off, you know, in their little cubicles, is just, it's new and it's unnatural.
Indeed. Yeah, this is actually a big factor in my own thinking about maybe relocating, because, you know, God willing, I will fulfill my biological function someday, and I am certain that I do not want the Macedonian state educating my children, and there is no homeschool in Macedonia. It's illegal. I'm going to have to move, you know, the if my child is born tomorrow, I have approximately 6 years to find a place to live so I can educate my children the way they ought to be educated, homeschooled. I do not trust the state, especially the state, you know, the occupation government of any white country to educate my children. So that's something to think about. Right. On the subject of child... Okay, go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, if we're able to deport the 13 plus million illegal immigrants in the United States, then I'm sure there would be room for you to come on over and still enforce an immigration moratorium, except for you. You'd be allowed.
I've heard that from so many Americans, like, I don't want to see any more immigrants, but you're okay. I don't know. It just sounds unprincipled. Like you get on, you spend a week with me, you pretty soon will want demand an immigration moratorium on all Macedonians. I'm not a very pleasant person to be around. Outside of the writer's blocks, obviously. But maybe it's because I'm putting all my charm into this show, and the rest of the week I'm just an unpleasant little. But I was saying, you know, I'm going to disagree with you on child labor. I say put the little shits to work, right? A lot of children are undisciplined these days, and I think it's because they lack responsibility. I'm not saying put them in the salt mines, okay, depending on a child, but when I was young, I had a bunch of chores around the house to do. My mother would put me to work, my father would put me to work, and it's important, especially for boys. I hated it at the time, but my grandfather got me to pick apples, right, every autumn at his apple orchard. And it really develops your self-discipline, your self-respect, because, you know, you're actually doing work. And for boys, it's important. You're developing a musculature, right, through mm-hmm. physical labor. I mean, I also played water polo. This is why all the way in my 30s, I have a very strong core strength, right? This is very important. A lot of people overlook core strength. But also a factor is that my family was not afraid to put me to work when I was younger, including some stuff that, you know, maybe in Western countries you wouldn't think about, yeah, let's have a child do this. But yeah, you're 12, you're 13, you're growing very fast. You need some difficulty in your life. Otherwise, you're just going to grow into a weak person, I think, as a man. Mm-hmm. And you have, oh, that's actually good from Reed Johnson. It's about young men developing physical confidence in themselves. Yeah, I think that is also important, but we can talk about also there's the martial aspect to it, which is why I think it's very important. Every man should know how to fight with his fists. This is actually another aspect of physical confidence in yourself. We do have donations. So any final thoughts about Ladies in the Lake, about Perilously Fair by Catherine S. Cyan?
Oh, just Catherine S., please write more. This is great content. We love it. So that's my final thought.
Excellent. Well, I'm also a big fan of Catherine, and she's in the chat. So ciao, Kat. Hope we can get you on the block pretty soon. I'm going to look for something for us to do together. It's happening. It's going to happen. We have donations, and people are asking questions of Cyan. We have Friedrich, who is our man in Romania. He says, Cyan, I just wanted to say thank you. I believe I know what it took to come down on our side while living in Seattle, which, when I had the occasion to visit, was as close to the paradise of that of what white people like, as far as I could tell. Thank you again. I think he means Seattle is paradise for white people.
Oh, it's true. It's true. And Friedrich, I loved your appearance on our birthday live stream, by the way. Thanks so much for coming on. I thought, you know, what you had to say was really poignant. So everybody, if you have the chance, go back and listen to that. But you're absolutely right. You know, Seattle, gosh, you've got the mountains on one, you've got Mount Rainier, Vitamin R over on one side, and the Olympics. And then you've got the Puget Sound, and you've got Vitamin R and the North Cascades on the east. And then on the west across the Sound, that's where you've got the Olympic Mountains. I used to ride my bike 14 miles a day on the waterfront to and from work at the time. And I would look out across the Sound to those mountains. And it really is paradise. And frankly, what they've done to Seattle in terms of Antifa and the drug problems is criminal. And so, you know, in fact, it's so bad right now that what's her name? I think it's Ann Davidson. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong here. But a Republican city attorney, you know, and now she's not a, I'm just looking it up right now. I don't want to share fake news. City attorney candidate. Here she is. So, you know, she's not a radical Republican by any means. You know, she's kind of a rhino, but for Seattle to elect, you know, a Republican is a really incredible feat. It shows that people are fed up. And so I really hope that that trend continues and it gets better. You know, I have this idea going, we need to recolonize. There's the decolonized movement, right, going on, but I propose the recolonized movement. So we'll, you know, move east for a while and then come back. So and run for office. In fact, there are people doing that there already. So I'm watching, cheering you on.
Yeah. I nominate Cyan for Queen of Washington State. We're going to bring back landed aristocracy to America. Personally, I got my dibs on, well, actually, I would have had my dibs on Seattle, because every time I see it on TV or in the movies, it looks like a magical place. I'm just not going to lie. And as someone who is a foul weather appreciator, I'm sure I would have just enjoyed myself in Seattle had I had the opportunity to visit or even live there. But yeah, from everything I hear about Seattle, it just sounds like basically what place where white people play around, where white people frolic and roam, live in this peaceful, I wouldn't say idyllic existence, but the idea of Seattle is really the idea of whitetopia to me. moderate, mild climate, surrounded by volcanoes, frequent earthquakes. I love living on the edge. It is the edge of the world, right? The West Coast, the left coast.
That's right. They're expecting that earthquake any day now that's going to destroy everything west of I-5, but people still live there. It's beautiful.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, Skopje is a very earthquake-prone area. It was completely destroyed in 1963 by a catastrophic earthquake. We even had an earthquake on the writer's block in January.
Oh,
it was
God.
Amazing. right. Live on the block, earthquake. Didn't damage anything, didn't do much damage, but put the fear of God in me.
There it's you go, content not. You can find anywhere else, live streaming in an earthquake.
Right. I'm thinking next time I get hit by a Russian missile. But we have more donations. We have a diamond from Sunday Sloth. This is on DLive, and he asks a question. Could Antifa not find better pictures to dox you with? I've seen the flyer. You and your husband look like kindly L.L. Bean catalog models. That's a cultural reference. I don't understand. What's an L.L. Bean catalog?
Oh, L.L. Bean. Okay, so they produce great outerwear, well, and slippers, and the L.L. Bean catalog. It's like it's where you go to buy your matching tartan print pajamas for Christmas. So it's extremely white centric. You know, they're trying to to insert Black models. Of course, but culturally, it's part of our heritage as white people. But thank you so much. That's so kind. You're really, really sweet. Actually, that picture that you're probably looking at is my husband and I, and then there's like a black hole in the middle, and you might be wondering what that is. Well, that's my daughter. And, this picture was taken on our anniversary. And it was lifted from my personal Instagram page, and I guess, you know, if they're going to share any photo, I guess the way I like the way it looks, so that's fine. But, it really made me mad. And that's not a good idea, frankly. And it didn't work out very well for them because, this is a story for another time, but, we took them to court. We gave them a hard time. And I started working full time in the movement. So I think it really backfired on them. In fact, I think, one of the Antifa, he was a member of the John Brown Gun Club. He was an ex-alcoholic. He started drinking again. You could tell in court. Among other things, I mean, I have so many stories from that. We're going to have to talk about them another time, but, Anyway. So it worked out great, and I like L.L. Bean.
Okay, well, that clears up we have $5 over on Odyssey from Reed Johnson, and he asks, has Cyan seen the excellent documentary Seattle is Dying, and what are her thoughts? And he has also included a link to the documentary over there. And if our moderators would just transfer that over to the DLive chat so people on DLive can hear it. Cyan, have you seen that documentary and what are your thoughts?
I have, and thank you so much, Reed Johnson. You're one of our long-suffering moderators. So thanks for doing that. And I have seen it. And they did a sequel as well. And if I am not mistaken, again, I don't want to be spreading fake news, but I think the same director might have also covered Los Angeles. It's definitely accurate. There was a lot of liberal screeching when it came out. Frankly, the theme is that, if we care about people, you can't let them just, live lives ODing on the streets. We lived in an area that was just uphill from the jungle, and the jungle was this massive homeless camp encampment. There were shootings there. A lot of the homeless, people can be homeless for many different reasons. Obviously I don't want them to be homeless. I want there to be services. But sometimes people are homeless because of addictions that they can't get out of. And it doesn't, you're not doing anyone any good to bring them into a homeless shelter, and then, give them needles, give them, at one point they were offering like drug enemas to homeless people as like a safer means. You just can't do this. But in that documentary, they interview several former drug addicts, who were homeless, and they will tell you themselves that the thing that saved me or the thing that sent me to rehab was getting arrested. frankly, and going to rehab. So now, you know, there are a lot of problems with just arresting people and not having those rehab services available or in place. But it, you know, you have a duty to protect your society and give people a reasonable, safe community to live in. And one of the ways you serve your community is by helping them break these cycles of addiction.
Are we talking about white people being homeless?
Yeah, actually, I mean, there's a good cross-section.
Because I hear Seattle is always, people say it's the whitest major urban agglomeration of America. Is this drug problem and crime problem and homelessness problem, is this affecting the white population of Seattle?
It does. You know, I'm interested in to look into the statistics of who ends up being homeless. I mean, there certainly are a lot of white people who are on drugs such as heroin specifically. But for example, in Pioneer Square, it always seemed to me, just from the observer's perspective, that I don't remember exactly what the percentages are at the time. I think Seattle overall is still 74% white. Somebody in the chat can correct me if I'm wrong. I've been away for a while, so I haven't looked into it. But the homeless population didn't correlate with those numbers exactly. There's one, I wish I could burn it out of my mind, but there's this black homeless man that wanders around Pioneer Square flashing everybody. I don't know what's going on. If the police are just, the police are afraid to arrest these people. Because they're afraid of being persecuted, and you know, maybe they're afraid of violence too. But you know, what happens if they do arrest them, right? You arrest them, you know, maybe book them for one night, but there's no solution. You just let them out again. Around the time of my departure, there was someone who had lifted up a woman. There's this overpass in Pioneer Square, which is close to the downtown. It's around where the courthouse is, and you're maybe like four or five blocks away from the retail core. And he had picked up this woman on her way to work in the morning at 8 o'clock in the morning and attempted to throw her over the overpass. So this is the kind of thing that's going on in Seattle. So anyway, back to the decolonize, recolonize movement. I mean, we could just let them, eat themselves. And once it is a post-apocalyptic hellhole, we can come back and then, you know, restore things.
We shall return cloaked in courage, and our sword shall be the truth. Or so I'm, I'm sorry, Leroy Patterson in the chat is saying Nick trying to stop grinning about the Congoloid streaker. You're absolutely right. I mean, I Cyan describes it so vividly that I just couldn't help but go. I'm reminded of this one time. I was like, I think I was four, maybe 4.5 years old. We were playing football, me and my, this is, you know, soccer, European football, me and my friends out on the street. And at the time on my street, there was this, hair salon for ladies, and this was the early 90s. So they would have, you know, the big bell things over their heads for the perms, right? Although I think those are coming back because now men are getting perms. It's disgusting. It's horrible. We need to recolonize men's hair, you know, no more perms. But anyways, there was this maniac. He was in a trench coat, and he exposed himself to the ladies. And they started screaming, you know, these are middle-aged ladies, maybe, you know, they clearly find it uncomfortable. But to us kids, it was hilarious. And, you know, he's exposing himself. He's advertising his meat, and then he runs away. And I come back home. I can't stop laughing. My mom asks, "What's going on?" I said, "This one man, he showed his pee pee to the ladies in the hair in the hairdressers," and it was one of the funniest moments of my life. Of course, this was a white guy. This is Macedonia in the 90s. Black people are basically outlawed, or might as well be. But it is a very interesting episode. Naked people in public. I'm going to be joining their ranks pretty soon if the temperature does not let up. But for the time being, I remain clothed, thankfully. We have another $5 donation from Reed Johnson over on Odyssey. And he says, the sequel is called The Fight for the Soul of Seattle. He posts the links. And Como News, K-O-M-O News, that's, I guess, a local news station, also did A Tale of Three Cities. All three documentaries are well worth people's time. And if you will, Mr. Johnson, just or some other mod, post those links also in the DLive chat because people might want to access them later on. We've spoken quite a lot about Seattle, and personally, I'm always interested in the in Seattle, in the Pacific Northwest in general, because I guess just because I came to white nationalism through Countercurrents, a lot of my online friends, American friends, are from the Pacific Northwest, but I also always felt an affinity for that place. It's like it's been calling to me over the vast distances of space and time. So it saddens me to hear that it is declining. Like a lot of places in America, it is not in good shape. We do have some articles to move on to. And you mentioned L.L. Bean catalog and how it's been replacing white people with black people in their advertising material and the promotional material. And here we have one from Stephen Paul Foster, great guy, excellent guest on the Writer's Block. We did the last month's best month ever with him. He says, okay, let's see the full name of the article, Blackness, Fatness, and the Great Placement at Target. And it's about, so basically it's about Stephen. He goes into a Target in Ohio, and he sees an obese black woman on on advertising material and is therefore traumatized for life. It's horrible. He can't look away. It's horrible, but he can't look away. It's like a car crash. And it's essentially, there is apparently a project going on, which is called The Great Reimagining, in which there is apparently a deliberate policy to remove white people from advertising material and replace us with blacks, with browns, to remove fit people and replace them, not us because I'm not in shape, with obese people, overweight people, people who should not be modeling. That's interesting. You know, it just conceptually erase white people from the public consciousness, start with advertising, with movies, with the film, before they move on to actually erasing us. I'm pretty sure you have some thoughts on this.
No, I definitely do. It actually is so depressing because I still shop at Target. I try not to, because of the reasons that Stephen Paul Foster cites in here, you know, and it is depressing. I have seen that same poster in my local Target. But it's one of those stores where, I don't know if you've ever been traveling, right? But, and you want something that is, that you know from home, right? It's familiar to you. Well, okay, there are no Safeways, or Fred Meyers, like east of the Mississippi, but there are Targets. So this is, you know, unfortunately, I still go there. But I have noticed, you know, over the past, it's been especially prominent over the past year or so, where they've made Santa Claus black as well. And I thought this was really alarming. And there were Santa Claus socks, and you've got the black Santa Claus socks, and then you've got the white Santa Claus socks. And, you know, it's like making the Little Mermaid black, or the fairy godmother a black gay person, you know, in Cinderella. It's just, it's, I can't imagine even white liberals walking in and not feeling like these are our traditions. But in terms of just sales, I mean, I suppose they are reflecting a upcoming demographic. I mean, the Great Replacement is real, and the Great Replacement you can see first in advertising. But also, frankly, Target should know better, because I think they were looted something like 1,000 times in the Black Lives Matter Summer of Love. So you think somebody over there, you know, would clue in and say, you know, maybe we don't want to attract these people to our stores. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I don't think it's a question of attracting people. I think it's not a business decision that Target is making, but quite consciously a political decision, because the careers of CEOs and various corporate bureaucrats, they no longer depend on making money. They depend on believing the right things and promulgating the right political agenda, because ultimately, even if the company does lose money, I think that its allies in the woke industrial complex, and there is definitely a massive woke industrial complex in America and other countries, are more than going to reward the company or maybe its individual members. Right? This is a, I think this is a function of the agency problem. How can the CEO go? If the CEO is given a chance of advancing his personal interests over the company interests, right, he's going to do it, and he's going to do it in a way in which he cannot be caught, right? I think a large percentage of wokery is driven by this fact that the managerial class is actually quite divorced from the fate of the companies they're supposed to manage. These companies could very easily go bankrupt, and these people are just going to move on to the next thing, right? They right. have a free option, as we would put it. And it's, and I love it. It's like we have this, one of the most popular articles on countercurrents is Richard Houck's The War Against Whites in Advertising. And I would like the mods to just put it in the chat for everyone to read. I'm sure everyone has already read it, but read it again, because it's one of the best we have. White people are being removed from, and it's like you're walking through Macedonia. The country is overwhelmingly white. And I see an advertisement for perfume, which shows a black man and a white woman. She's hugging him. She's pawing his bare chest. I'm like, are you trying to sell perfume? Because here in Macedonia, we're not really shy about voicing our distaste for the idea of interracial relationships, right? People are very actively disgusted by the, very openly disgusted. Even people calling themselves liberal are not very open to this idea of interracial relationships. You're pushing it in our faces. You're not selling any perfume with that here. No, no. But it's still happening, which tells me that there is no economic incentive for these companies at play. This is purely political for them.
That is a really interesting perspective. I hadn't thought about the concept, frankly, about them losing money over this in other countries that are, you know, that are more sensitive to that, or where there are more other options. Mostly because I think in America, you've got, I mean, if you think of the big companies that are pushing these things, you know, Target, Amazon, you know, even Walmart, they are, I think that they're doing so out of, you know, number one, I agree with you that I think that they see themselves as part of a different social class. You know, frankly, they're enforcing a new norm, and they're not part of the average society. And also they're anti-fragile to the average person's, you know, dislike for this kind of thing being forced upon them, because they have monopolies, right? So I live in a rural area right now, and I, you know, frankly, there are a lot of things that I get delivered to me. I don't want to shop on Amazon, but it's one of the only options if you want to get X, Y, or Z, you know. So I think that that's one reason, you know, they feel comfortable pushing it, even in societies that would typically reject that kind of thing, because they have the monopoly. And then two, they see themselves as a different part of society, you know, with what the World Economic Forum, right? I mean, they're part of that social class. There's a company out there, Salesforce, and they, I mean, that CEO will say openly, and this is reflected in other companies too, but I was just familiar with Salesforce because we worked with them when I was still at the insurance company, right? And they are constantly pushing this, you know, these woke emails down your throat. They have a department of diversity, inclusion and equity die. So, you know, they have their own department for this, right? What does that have to do with the customer management system? Nothing, but their CEO will say Salesforce is a double bottom line company, meaning they have their sales, their business bottom line, but that's not the only thing that matters to them. What matters to them also is enforcing this social change. And they feel they can do it most effectively by monopolizing the market and then only allowing certain clientele to use it.
It's very interesting. And people have commented that basically when the Gillette app came, which was very openly anti-white, as they tried to boycott Procter & Gamble, and quickly they realized that everything on the shelf at the supermarket, all of the cosmetics, all of these toothbrushes, everything is Procter & Gamble. Right? It's one of these things you realize that basically we live in a giant palace economy. There is no free market, probably never was. What we have is essentially a cabal of people who own everything and act out the economy for us. You know, decisions are being made for us, what we're going to consume, how these things are going to happen. And we have these illusions of choices, right? Are you going to have Pepsi or Cola? What is the fundamental difference there? None, really. And sometimes they don't even bother with the pretense, like with Amazon, for example. Which is, I guess, a problem unique to America, because I've never really used Amazon for anything except books. And even then I did it because there was really no other option whatsoever. It happened once. Mm-hmm. I always prefer to go to a brick and mortar store because I can hold the thing I'm trying to purchase. I'm thinking about buying an electric shaver, so I go to the electronics store and I hold the thing in my hand because I'm going to be putting it on my face. So it's very important to me, but it's it is important. People in America, I would guess, because of the destruction of American cities, just don't have that luxury. If you live in a suburban, exurban, whatever area, whatever you want to call them, it's, I guess, more difficult to live than it is for me here in Europe. I live in a downtown area of a big city. I have everything within walking distance, although I don't know if I'm going to have that privilege for much longer, because all of the problems of America are going to come to Europe as well eventually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This brings me to one here work-related item. I'm hoping somebody out there can help me out with this, because there is an alternative emerging to Amazon, and it's called My Store from Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy. Okay, so this is one of my just personal goals.
Oh, come on. Okay. Oh, come on. Not the MyPillow guy.
I need an advertisement from him in the sidebar section. Would that not be great? I would love to host that app.
We are a classic site. We are the University of the Discerned Right. We're not hawking pillows. goes for. I'm okay with selling fungal tea and all of these things, but I'm not, I don't know.
I think this would be a great business decision. I mean, hey, if money comes in, pillows go out. I'm okay with that. The bigger point that I'm bringing up is that, you know, it'll take a while, but there eventually will be alternatives to these things. I mean, Gab, I suppose, is an example of that. I know you have opinions on Gab, so maybe that's a bad example to bring that up. But I think that eventually there's hope. It is difficult to break out of these things. But in all seriousness, if somebody out there has the contact for the MyPillow guy, let's see if he wants to advertise on Countercurrents, because I think it'd be good for business.
Well, if you can get the MyPillow guy to advertise on Countercurrents, I'm going to incorporate a pillow fight into every best month ever type show on the writer's block.
If that's not an incentive, I don't know what is.
Right. So people, just go out there and pester Mike Lindell until he agrees to finance Countercurrents, so you can see me being beaten to death with pillows. I've actually not been in a pillow fight for the better part of 5 years, so I might need a refresher course in pillow fighting. It is what it is, I guess. So I guess, that we have exhausted the subject of advertising and how whites are getting pushed out. And there is apparently a formal program, the program of the great, the great reimagining, right? They are reimagining the population of the United States, the customer base of these large companies, which are in many cases lily white. I don't know if non-white people even shop at Target, all these places, right? They reimagine them as blacks, it's in browns and yellows and all of the colors of a puddle of mud. It is what it is, I guess. Oh, and people are pointing out that Target is also notorious for being at the forefront of tranny bathrooms. Well, whoop-de-doo. Hooray for Target. Yeah, pillow guy. you can't start advertising here a moment sooner, because unfortunately I think that white identitarianism, white nationalism, is the only way out of this. We cannot, you know, just dump the whole Trump crew. We are people who will be hawking your pillows. I will catch a goose feather to the face for our cause. I will sacrifice myself. We have donations. We have Sunday Sloth donating a diamond, another diamond. And you can append those to the donation, Sunday. He asks, Zion, has CC ever considered billboard advertising? Okay.
I think this is a great idea, actually. I will tell you one thing, though. Okay, billboards are very expensive. So thank you for your donations. But it's definitely, it can be effective, both in terms of just the media exposure in terms of the billboard itself, but you get all of these, everybody else is freaking out about it publicly. It puts the newspapers in a bad position, because on the one hand, if they don't say anything about it, it's as if they're endorsing the existence of this billboard. If they do say something about it, then they're giving you free publicity. So I do think this is a fantastic idea. It's just a matter of an allocation of resources. One example of this happening was the IHR, the Institute for Historical Review. It's IHR.org. They put up an ad. It's very innocuous. It just says History Matters and IHR.org at the bottom. And they put up this ad in a subway station. And it was, you know, it caused this huge uproar, you know, the way that I explain it. And so I think that that's the only case that I can think of just in recent memory of one of our organizations doing something like that. But it's definitely something that. Anyway, it's a great idea. So totally endorse it. Just a matter of money.
Yeah. So, you know, for my part, I mean, I don't know how effective billboards are as advertisements. It's going to get vandalized, right, if you start advertising pro-white stuff explicitly. But we know that Patriotic Alternative in the United Kingdom has had success with banner drops and leafletting. Billboards are a little next level, but if we do have the resources for it, yeah, why not go for it? You know, if we actually do have money to burn and we do get Mike Lindell turning on the pillow buck spigot and all this. I mean, the chat is just going wild with that theme. We have Friedrich Richter saying, can't wait to get my Heidegger pillow. Are you talking about those Japanese pillows? You want to hug Martin Heidegger? Oh, I'm not going to get into it. I hear you Romanians are a strange people. I did meet a Romanian girl once in Greece. She was strange, but very, very, very fine example of womanhood. We are getting a little off track here. We have another donation from Reed Johnson for $5. He says, Imperium Press just did a good documentary called Why is Capital Woke? And they discuss companies using United Nations mandated ESG scores, a metric of woke compliance, and other metrics determined by the Davos Forum. And he includes a link, which, again, moderators would just share that to DLive as well. So people on DLive can also just put that in their bookmarks, I guess. I have not seen, I saw Mike from Imperium Press share that. It's on my list of things to see because apparently, you know, you don't really have much time when you're trying to prepare the writer's block every week and do a weekly article. I'm also working tirelessly behind the scenes and on the scenes. I like the spotlight. I'm not going to lie about it. But I am going to watch that, and I'm going to, if I like it, if I think it's adding to the discussion, I might actually do a write-up about it. Thanks for bringing it to my attention, Reed. You're a champ. You seen that documentary, Cyan?
No, I haven't, but I'll definitely watch it. And I'm glad you mentioned doing a write-up or a review of it. You know, you would be a great candidate to do that if you have time. If you don't have time, I bet Spencer Quinn would do a good job with it too. I think he recently reviewed another documentary on transgenderism, the What is a Woman one. Oh, and actually he reviewed another documentary, the one that NJP put out on Waukesha? Not sure.
It's called Waukesha.
Waukesha. But yeah, so he does a great job with reviews too. He's actually not my husband, so I'm not just plugging my husband out there. I get this question all the time. I really like him, definitely endorse his work. My husband is a different Spencer.
It's, I guess it's because of the Quinn thing, right? Insofar as that's your actual surname, it could cause confusion, but I hear it's very common in America, everywhere where you have Irish people. So,
that's right. We like to LARP with our last name. Right. Every St. Patrick's Day.
People were commenting that I actually said Queen at the beginning instead of Quinn. That's an old Slavic disease because there is no distinction in many languages between the two vowels. Right. Sometimes it happens to me. It's the easiest way to confirm that I'm not an American. It's one of these things you'd never fully drop, even though I have the fake American accent. I think it's time we moved on to something else. Let's talk about the male relationship fantasy, because we moved on to the subject of marriage and we touched upon it briefly. You mentioned this from James Dunphy, male relationship fantasies. It's very interesting. It's actually a little controversial. And I found that I disagreed with some of the things said here, but it is a fine piece of writing. And I'm sure it's going to stimulate discussion between us in the chat. And I would like to draw people's attention to this article. So, well, you brought it up when we were discussing cats thing. So why don't you start commenting on it, Cyan?
Yeah, no, this was definitely a good article. And I, one of the things that he does point out is that women are attracted, you know, not only to money, I mean, but other forms of status too, like, you know, boldness, you know, I holding true to your ideals. You know, women are attracted to men who have strong ideological commitments and a passion for their both their life and improving the society that they live in. So it doesn't have to be financial necessarily. You don't always have to marry up, although that is really common. One of the things that stuck out to me, maybe this is just because I've never seen amounts of money this large, but one of the, it says, for example, Jessica Simpson, who is worth $200 million, married former NFL football player and Yale graduate Eric Johnson, who is only worth $10 million. This was an example of marrying down, and I'm not sure what the difference is between 200 and 10 million. But apparently, I mean, it must be, it's probably significant, you know, to celebrities like that. But I love the way that he closes, where he says, you know, women are drawn to the bold. Fortune favors the bold, even awkward boldness, as against the prim and proper wallflower. So, I mean, just go for it, man.
I think it's the specifically that thing. I think it's less the question of she married down. I think she was attracted to the fact that this guy's an athlete, so he's probably physically imposing. This is a factor. Women mm-hmm. like to be physically dominated. Don't ask me how I know that. It's, well, actually, yeah, you can't ask me how I know that. Well, months and months and years and many years, decades even, of experience with women.
many years of marriage.
Right, we're many both years married, of so. Marriage and just being around women. They like being around men who are physically, not just big and strong, but physically expressive. This, I mean, why women find men who know how to dance attractive, because dancing implies mastery of your own body, which means you can use that body for other things like, you know, martial achievement, achievement in physicality. So physicality is very important. But ultimately, I think this whole issue of income is a red herring. In my experience, what women find attractive in a man is mastery. Really, just that the man is master of the house, keeper of the keys, master of his domain, that he can, first of all, rule himself. This is actually very important, and we don't teach men to rule themselves in our modern world. We teach men to be ruled by women, first and foremost, which is a very... Mm-hmm. You mentioned the whole thing about She-Hulk being a lawyer. I was looking at that. I was looking at the promotional art, and I thought, who would watch this, right? Why, men are not going to watch this. Women are not going to watch this. This is going to be boring to women, unless there are these, you know, deformed Jewish masochistic single 45-year-old childless women, right? Who likes this idea of the She-Hulk as a lawyer? And it came to me. It's weak men. Weak men who've been brainwashed or whatever, intimidated into thinking that a woman should rule them and a woman should be sexually aggressive and should take charge in a relationship. So these are men who have been damaged by our system and now believe that they should take the passive, the feminine role.
I kind of wonder, in that sort of illustration too, I mean, do weak men actually like this kind of thing, or do they patronize this kind of art because they think they're supposed to, or they think that it weirdly, I mean, maybe it does. It weirdly gives them some kind of alternative status in this woke world where we value, you know, where we value manly women, or feminist men. So, I mean, But maybe that's just too crazy and, you know, doing some intellectual backflips.
Yeah, it's possible, but I do think it's primarily this, because weak men are essentially sexually dysfunctional because they are unattractive to women. I think it's really the fantasy of, oh, there's going to be a woman. She's going to coax me out of my shell like you know, Rocky did to, what's his wife's name in Rocky 1? I forget. The one played by, I forget the actress's name, Coppola's daughter or whatever.
My husband would know.
Talia Shire, right. So you got Sylvester Stallone coaxing Talia Shire, Adrian, right, the chat corrects me, out of her shell. And I think this is the male fantasy, the weak man's fantasy of She-Hulk is going to coax me out of my shell. She's going to see what a kind and gentle soul I am. She's going to be very attracted to me because of it. One major point of disagreement I have with James Dunphy is that he said that highly intelligent men who cannot find highly intelligent women to mate with should, these are his words, get over themselves, right? Accept you're going to have a lower IQ wife and make babies with her. And that's something I don't think that high IQ men should accept. I mean, I'm looking at this from my own experience, right? I sometimes beside my against my better judgment, because this is all happening at the emotional level, I have contempt for people who are lower IQ. I shouldn't, right? I'm not saying this is good. I'm just saying it happens. It happens to me. It happens to a lot of people who are maybe above average in intelligence. It also happens, right, if you're someone who has, you're someone just incompatible in temperament with someone. I think it's very dangerous if you're a high IQ man and your children come out and they're lower IQ or maybe average IQ because you've made it with this average woman. You're going to, I think, develop a contempt for them. And I think the worst thing that can happen to a man when he's young is that his father should have contempt for him. It's also bad for girls as well. I think it would actually hurt the children quite a lot. And ultimately, there would be no point to the reproduction. I say do not settle for a low IQ woman, even if it does mean holding out a little longer. Really, we should be breeding for higher IQ. We should be breeding for higher performance. And ultimately, I don't think that there can be the sort of love that ought to be between man and wife if the man also has this contempt for the wife as well. It's just high IQ man with low IQ wife, I don't see that happening, especially if the man later becomes successful in his career and meets women of similar IQ through this career, right? This is going to ultimately destabilize the marriage. And that's all I'm going to say about the subject. It happens, right? These things happen. People do stupid things because they are seized by animal attractions. And I say to people, trust your instinct, trust your gut instinct, your animal attractions, right? This is your evolutionary wisdom telling you who is your optimal breeding partner. Do not overthink these things. Trust your heart.
That's another good point. You bring up two good points there that I didn't think about. You know, number one, if you are in an imbalanced relationship and you end up picking someone with a lower IQ, naturally IQ, you know, correlates with having the same sense of humor, getting the same jokes, you know, being able to have a fun conversation and flow freely. So I hadn't thought about that particular aspect, you know, of that harming the children. If they see, you know, they, because children are like sponges, you know, they pick up all the emotions, you know, and frankly, I mean, so do pets. If you're a pet parent too, I mean, you have to be sensitive to your cats and dogs. They will know if one party feels contempt for the other. So that's a good point. And then the second one, see, I've already lost track of it because my husband's been asking me to take this IQ test, but I'm pretty sure it's around 98 because I can't remember the second point that you said.
right, maybe no, that's actually, that's the one thing has nothing to do with the other. Good memory is actually probably a sign of low IQ. I don't know. I sometimes it was a very embarrassing moment this afternoon. Me and the missus, we went to the mall and I was holding on to the check because you get validated parking. And she said, "Why are you holding on to this? We came on foot." I'm like, "Did we? I distinctly remember driving today." And I did drive, but just not to the mall. So yeah, it's one of those things, I guess.
No, well, but, I'm sure it's important. I'm sure it'll come back to me. But I think that, you should marry someone. The second point, this is what you said. You know, you follow your gut, follow your instincts. And somebody, it's interesting that you bring that up. Someone else who is very important to me said the same thing. You know, I had recent interaction where I misjudged someone. And they said, you need to follow your initial gut reaction with people in some cases. You know, I try to judge everyone as an individual and I have to be charitable. But one of the things that he said was, especially when you're getting into, you know, maybe it's a working relationship, maybe it's a partnership for, creative purposes, you're joining a band together or something. If you have a bad feeling about it, don't do it, because you are, those visceral feelings are a product of hundreds of thousands of years of evolution and selective breeding in your ancestry. And so you have to be careful not to rationalize over those feelings. You know, the two should be in sync and you should get to know yourself better. So I think that that's a really good point and very good advice. As per the article, there are a couple of things that stood out to me. One of the supporting points that Mr. Dunphy uses is that he says white people breed best at an IQ of around 100. I might be misinterpreting this. Maybe there are other control factors that he controlled for when he was looking this up. But I think part of the reason for that, frankly, is because, you know, higher IQ people are stuck in professions that don't allow them to have children until they're, 30, 35. They tend to postpone having children due to low impulse or due to high impulse control. And then people who have lower IQs have low impulse control as well. I mean, this is the opening scene of Idiocracy. I don't think that point necessarily flows into the argument of, you should just give up looking for an IQ, high IQ partner and then go with somebody low IQ. I don't think that follows. But one of the other observations that I had in mind when reading this article was there is, and maybe I'll get in trouble for saying this with some segments of the right, but I don't think that just having as many children as possible is the be all and the end all in fighting the great replacement. Whites have always been a global minority. We just don't want to be a minority in our own homelands. We are not, frankly, going to outcompete. It's not in our nature, I think, to outcompete or outbreed. Mexicans or Blacks, they have higher fertility rates, no matter what their circumstances are. So you know, the thing that we, the biggest things we need to do to stop the great replacement, I mean, frankly, is, well, you know, encourage, stop demonizing white culture. Number one, we should be proud of who we are and happy, you know, and celebrate our cultural heritage. And then also take political steps to, you know, stop immigration, immigration moratorium, you know, exactly what I said before. So if we are, you know, if we are in our own white homeland, our own white society, then we don't have to, we don't have to engage in this race of who can produce the most children, you know, because overpopulation, you know, overpopulation has its negative effects too. So there's an article that Greg Johnson wrote, you know, he's obviously much more articulate than I am. The why environment, what exactly is the title? I think it's why environmentalists should have more children. And it's because, you know, the basic premise is that, you know, having more and more children is not, you know, necessarily always, you know, a good in and of itself, but you know, we do need to balance out the number of whites who are being born with high IQ and the whites who care about the environment too, if we want to protect it for future generations. So anyways, definitely it's an oldie but a goodie. So if someone wants to find that and put it in the chat, I'd be grateful.
I'm sure our Hebronic moderators would will do exactly that. They are very good at finding these from just two sentences. Oh, and right here it is. Environmentalists should have large families, right in the chat as I'm saying it. And I'm going to add to what you said about the demographic realities, the fertility rates, like whites are maybe the most K-selected race on the planet, whereas everyone else is R selected. Everyone else is concerned with just quantity of offspring, whereas we as white people are very concerned with quality of offspring, right? We just do not have the biological framework, let alone the cultural framework, to outbreed the rest of the world. But I think people are focusing on, I'm not saying don't have white babies, but I think people are focusing on we should have giant families, because they're not looking at the 500, 600 pound gorilla in the room, which is, we don't win this by outbreeding every other race on the planet. We win this by removing them from white nations. And that's something I think even white identitarians and vast swathes of the dissident right are just uncomfortable with discussing, this necessity of, in the future, if we are going to have white homelands, we are going to have to remove some non-whites. Hopefully the overwhelming majority of non-whites from white countries. Repatriation is the word, and not just of people who immigrated, people who were born here, people who have citizenship. Sorry, if you're not white, you're going to have to go back. Right? I suspect that even identitarians, even white nationalists, even if in their heart of hearts they know this, they might be uncomfortable with the idea. So pathologized is the idea of a nation as an exclusive club you're simply born into and it cannot simply join.
Right. And I think it's important to bring up too, I mean, this process of repatriation does not have to be violent. It can be humane. And a lot of, a lot of non-whites would like that too. I mean, there's always going to be a few exceptions here and there. Frankly, I had a conversation. First of all, if one of our moderators, if you haven't already, if you want to put the article Restoring White Homelands in the chat by Greg Johnson, that is his chapter in the White Nationalist Manifesto that addresses this. These are the, you know, graduated steps that we have to take if we want to we want to restore a white homeland. And the other point that I was going to bring up is, we can find, there are non-white allies actually who want the same thing. They specifically, you know, one example is there's a Hawaiian nationalist movement. And I mean Hawaiians as an actual people who live in Hawaii. I know that that was a code term for something else, but there's a Hawaiian nationalist movement, and they, you know, where they want to be a separate, distinct people, just with, you know, with trade agreements with the rest of the United States. So that's one example. Another example is, many of these Afghan refugees or Somalians would be happier in, you know, fleeing to a country that it shares more closely their cultural identity. They'd be much more comfortable there. And I think that they would welcome that as a solution as well. Even Mexicans who come up here, for labor, and then they send remittances back home. If we had some kind of agreement to send them back, and I think a lot of them would be happy doing that. I mean, I have a friend who confided, you know, she is a Mexican. She is here. She doesn't like, white society. She doesn't like the United States. She feels like she has to be here for work. And so I think that, you know, you could read this article and say, oh my gosh, that would be so horrible to repatriate all of these recent immigrants. But there are a lot of people on the other side who feel the same way, and they want separation too. But for some reason, we're prevented from going to the negotiating table because that would be racist.
Yeah, it's something I guess people are just not psychologically prepared to accept. That, I mean, I've spoken about this. Ultimately, this whole notion of everyone wants to live in America or everyone wants to live like a white person is parochial. There's no other way of putting it. It's just some small town guy, no offense to small town people, but some small town bumpkin assumes that the entire world wants to live like him. No, the world is huge. It's very diverse. No, diversity, it's a dirty word in these circles, but the world is very, very deeply diverse. Lots of different people out there. White people are rightfully disgusted and disturbed by what goes on in Africa. But this is the revealed preference of how Black people want to live. The violence, the social instability, it's a feature, not a bug for white people, is for Black people. And I don't think we as white people should force them to live like us. I think it's mighty parochial to assume, oh, they just want a better life. What do you mean by that better life? You want them to live like white people? They're not white. They don't want to live like you. I mean, even within white people, I know that Balkan people from the Balkans, from South Europe, don't like living like Northwestern Europeans. You go to Italians, you tell them to live like Germans, they get offended. But you say, oh, mm-hmm. You're going to be richer if you live like Germans. Yeah, that means working more. We don't want to make that sacrifice. It's a choice people make. It's a stereotype, but it's actually true. I've met Germans, I've met Italians. Italians are okay with having less money if it means having more leisure time. It's a choice they make. It's a free choice people should make. Right? Mm-hmm. And these are two groups of white people who are more similar to each other than they would like to admit sometimes. And still you have this vast difference. So yeah, this is one of those important things we should pay attention to. And yeah, I'm not going to stop beating that drum. Liberalism, this whole notion that, oh, everyone wants to live like you, it's deeply, deeply parochial. It's also a very good rhetorical own. You just bring these white liberals down to earth that actually you're not taking the revealed preference of Africans or Mexicans, realistically speaking. But I do think that people are uncomfortable with the idea of repatriation, ethnic cleansing, right? Because it conjures up images of mass graves and just grandmothers being kicked off of their ancestral land. It is very unpleasant. I'm not going to lie about it. We do have about 10 minutes remaining. I'm just going to refresh the donation page because let's see if we have any new donations. I'm not sure. This could be from yesterday, but it says in honor of Martin Rojas. It's for $50 American by Matt Stone. Well, thank you for the $50 American, Matt. Did you know Matt Rojas, Cyan?
I did know Martin Rojas. So thank you so much for sending that in. You know, he deserves all of our respects. He was an incredibly productive person. I had the privilege. I didn't know him as well as some others, but I, you know, we did go bowling several times together and had meals together. And you know, he was one of those people where, you know, we made movement plans together. He was always coming up with good ideas, and he was incredibly prolific. You know, as Greg mentioned in his article honoring him, you know, frankly, when he got doxxed, he didn't realize that this person, that Martin Rojas, was under, you know, made up at least 5 different people. And Jared Taylor mentioned in his tribute as well that there are pen names out there that probably even he doesn't know about. So he was just the example of someone who was thinking, writing, working for the movement, and in it for the movement and not for his own recognition. And he's just so, it was a very honorable person. So thanks for sending that in.
I did not have the privilege of meeting Martin or even just conversing with him, but it's always good to remember those of us who fall in battle for whatever reason, right? It's going to be a long, hard slog, and some of us are just not going to see the end of it. I'm prepared for it. People watching, people taking part in this, you should psychologically prepare for the possibility that we might be doing this for the next century. I find that a lot of people think that, oh, I'm going to give it my all, means they get to die heroically. Well, no, it just means you're going to have to live in a very disciplined and consistent way. Just keep banging at a couple of drums. It's not fun sometimes. Sometimes it's just you got to say the same things over and over again because somebody's got to say them, because people could at the at that very moment be open to hearing about them, right?
Oh, that's exactly right. Greg brought this up on a podcast with Gregory Hood over at Ameren, how, you know, you just are repeating sometimes a lot of the same statements, but you never know if someone's hearing the argument for the first time. I mean, how countercurrents, okay, we just celebrated our 12th year. Well, the podcast, the Countercurrents Radio episodes that were coming out around 2015, 2016, 2017, those, I'm sure glad Greg Johnson was repeating the same things for 7-8 years there. So yeah, you never know.
Yeah, this is something that I'm a repeat offender. Like, I hate repeating myself. If I've said something, right, even if it's in an article which is 4 years old and nobody's going to look for, like, in the 54th page in the archive, I'm just not going to repeat it. As a matter of general, I wouldn't even call it principle, I would call it obstinacy. But it's important to have people who are willing to just beat the drum of demographic replacement, white identitarianism, the basics. These are very important things. Although with the writer's block, I find that I'm always recentered because we keep coming back to these themes which are very important to us and to our movement, and how we should keep our eye on the ball ultimately. So that's very important. So let's close this off with, because we were talking about reproduction, we were talking about whites and advertising, we were talking about the return of femininity insofar as it is possible. Let's close this off with Aquilonius's self-improvement or societal improvement. Now, Aquilonius, this is why I love Countercurrents. He does not give an answer. He just poses a question. I mean, he does give an answer at the end, but far more important is the question. Do we try to self-improve? And this is all very important for the men, especially, do we strive to improve ourselves? Or do we accept certain factors are, well, beyond our control and take action to set them right at the societal level, at the political level, at the local level, you know, in America, state and federal, in Europe, at the level of country, or maybe a transnational authority like the European Union. I think it's a question we ought to, at the very least, pose and give a lot of thought, actually, to. How much of your problems in your life are due to your own shortcomings, and we all have shortcomings and they all cause problems, but how much, what percentage of the problems in your life are, well, quite beyond your control? There's a big, big, big chunk of problems in everyone's life who are just because of, well, them's the times. I want to hear your thoughts, Cyan.
Well, I came across a fantastic saying recently, and it was, blessed are the flexible because they will remain unbroken. And I think that, you know, that it's just kind of a stoic philosophy of life. I think that there are a lot of things that are outside of your control, but you shouldn't let that bother you. Because I think self-improvement, and societal improvement, I think that they go hand in hand. I think this is the kind of the conclusion that Aquilonius comes to, is that, you know, it looks, that level of involvement, macro political involvement is different for every person. But I think that, you know, given the sense that your society, your nation is an extension of your family, frankly, it's an extension of yourself. I think that self-actualization, that process of actualizing your best virtues is, you know, that's the step number one. And it just naturally expands into improving your nation as a group with other people, you know, whether that takes the form of activism, whether that takes the form of just being a good neighbor, and, you know, having loyalty to your friends in your society, being a good example in society, having a good sending a good example for your children and your family life, exercising is great. And it improves the society around you, because when you are exercising and taking care of your health, then health insurance prices go down. So I think, I mean, Frank, that's kind of a silly example, but I do think that it's generally.
So it's actually a very good example. We were talking about Black people, the great reimagining, right? Fat Black people being put up on billboards. Well, if you're walking around and you're looking good and you look fit and healthy, you are fighting back against the great reimagining. It's just a fact of life. If you look around and you're a handsome white woman out of an L.L. Bean catalog, you are doing something on the aesthetic front. Well, that's very important, I think.
Yeah. So people who have fitness channels or, you know, they have groups centered around martial arts and stuff like that. I mean, I think that that's an integral part of, nation improvement as well. And maybe that is the best, that's the best fit for you, where you feel the most comfortable contributing, then go for it. You know, there are plenty of white advocates and we all have different talents.
I agree with that. I will add, as an addition to what Aquilonius poses, there is I don't know if it's in Western Christianity, but there is an Orthodox prayer, which is, give me the strength to bear to change the things I can change. Give me the strength to bear the things I cannot change. and give me the wisdom to distinguish between the two. And I find more as I become older and come across more and more things which I cannot just will, more obstacles I cannot just will into non-existence, just break apart with just slamming my head against them. It always worked in the past. I mean, there's a long, long trail of broken doors behind me, which have been, you know, wrested apart by this nogging. I don't know if it's in Western Christianity, but more and more that prayer has meaning for me. Mm-hmm. As I reach the limits of my own personal power, you know, it's something that happens when you realize you got a lot more road behind you than you thought. It's not an answer to the question, but it's a good enough heuristic for living in a world of uncertainty and a world where you're never really quite sure whether it's you personally or whether it's just the times. And that's good enough for me, I guess.
Right. And there can always be political miracles. Sometimes change, you know, change. I think Peter Brimelow said this, the change, nobody expected the Berlin Wall to come down. No one expected the fall of communism. Change can happen very slowly, and then all of a sudden it happens very fast. And that's one of the things Jared Taylor said. I wish I could cite it specifically, but I'm sure he said this multiple times, is when he started American Renaissance, he thought that he was just kind of cataloging a resistance for, you know, future curious generations to maybe dig up someday. But we, you know, we've seen a huge shift in the Overton window in just a few years. With Trump, for all his faults, changed the conversation on immigration. And now just in this race with Blake Masters, for example, he's running, and one of the things he said was, I mean, he was just very comfortable saying, well, I mean, frankly, the gun problem it's a problem with gangs in Chicago. I think the exact quote is, it's black people, frankly. And this is a politician running for office, you know, and someone who's polling very well. That's kind of unimaginable a few years ago. So all of the work that, you know, people are doing, I mean, you may think that you're not having any effect, just writing an article to be featured on the writer's block, but it does. It's part of a bigger picture. Something like 23% of Republicans say that white nationalism is a good thing. So there's, you know, these are all positive signs. It's definitely doing something.
Yeah, I gotta agree with that. I mean, some people don't like Blake Masters because of his associations, and I say we take what we can get until we can get everything. Then we take whatever the hell we want. we have our moments here in the writer's block. I see a donation from Sunday Sloth. Donates his third diamond for the evening. He says, thank you both, and the moderators too. Well, thank you, sir, for your donation. Your continuing support of Countercurrents and the Writer's Block is greatly appreciated. We have a diamond from Hondo Echo. Thank you, sir. That's 100 lemons, a diamond, and I think the conversion rate is $1. One pecking dollar, to quote Stefan Molyneux. And another diamond from Sunday Sloth, again with the diamond. And he has a question. Donations have a 50-character limit. Am I missing something? Well, Sloth, if you donate a diamond, you have a 50-character limit. I think that the character limit is a little more lenient if you donate a Ninja Gini or Ninjet. So keep that in mind. You know, if you have the lemons to spare, you can always send us an Injagini, and you can ask a question which is as long as you like.
And on that topic, we just unveiled a new option. So everybody at Countercurrent, so everybody's familiar with the super chats and these questions here, which are fantastic. You can commission an article. You can get a longer, more well thought through response now at Countercurrent. So in fact, I think it's the last article that's posted that went up there. But there are instructions up there. Somebody could post that in the chat. I would be grateful. Oh yeah, it's the first thing that pops up on the homepage. So commission your own article at Countercurrents. If you make a donation of $100 or more, there is no character limit to your question, and there is no character limit to the answer. So yeah, ask away.
Right. This is, I believe, available to everyone who has paywall privileges. You get once, you get to order one per year, unless I'm mistaken. It has to be in a subject we can cover, actually, in Countercurrent. So I'm not writing any treatises on why BMW is the superior vehicle to Mercedes. First of all, because it's not. Second of all, because I know nothing about cars, if I'm being completely honest. And, I know how to drive them. I know that if you push on the gas pedal, they tend to go forward. It's, I guess, one of those things. But I like it. It's a good idea. I don't have enough strings pulling me, right? I sing, I dance for Super Chats every Sunday on the writer's block just to keep the lights on and Countercurrents. It's a life. It's a living, I guess. Well, we are already 5 or 6 minutes over time, Sayan. So if you have any closing remarks, people have been asking, can they find you on social media? Or are you one of these throwbacks to the 90s, which treats social media like the devil?
I had a Twitter very briefly. I still think it exists. I just shut it down and don't post to it because I don't post to social media really at all because I view it as kind of a liability. In fact, this is a little bit nerve wracking for me too. I mean, what if I say something I regret? No, I don't have social media right now. Maybe that'll change with enough pressure. But right now you can find me on Countercurrents. And you can always email me too. I'm a dinosaur, so you can email me, cyan@counter-currents.com.
Right. That might be a good idea. Although I suspect some people are just looking for the LL Bean catalog pictures. you come across a woman who's actually feminine, demure. She's not an e-girl, and immediately people are saying, "Oh, where's her Instagram? Where's her Twitter? I want to see her pose in a sundress in a wheat field." It's disgusting, frankly. I'm sorry.
Sundress in a wheat field.
Yeah. I mean, sundresses are obviously the garment of choice for the conservative woman. I believe this is non-controversial. But yes, you can reach Cyan at cyan@counter-currents.com. You can send her, your best wishes. You can commission an article. You can communicate with the woman there. And I guess this has been the Writer's Block, the best month ever, the month of June on the Writer's Block. I'm your friend and host, Nick Gilvey, and our guest for tonight was Cyan Quinn, Program Director for Countercurrents. I want to thank everyone who donated. I want to thank everyone who tuned in to watch us live. I want to thank everyone listening to the replay of this show. I want to thank everyone in the chat. I want to thank our moderators, Reed Johnson, Gadius Maximus, Bartleby, for keeping the chat safe and for posting all of the links so that our audience can access them at their leisure. And I guess this is it. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. All right. Bye-bye. Bye, everybody. Bye.